Hi there, this is Mark Luke Carrier, welcoming you to the first episode of Fakes, Frauds, and Phonies. Now, before getting into the thick of it, let's answer a few common queries. I'm often asked, what are the oldest examples of art fraud? Now, it's hard to imagine a pair of hirsute primitive creatures admiring a cave drawing and one asking the other, is it an original? It's therefore safe to say that forgery began with the modern concept of exclusive authorship and ownership, both closely tied to financial value. Albrecht Dürer, who lived between 1471 and 1528, probably one of the earliest victims of forgery, was the toast of Nuremberg and one of Germany's most acclaimed artists. His paintings, drawings, copper engravings, and woodcuts were much in demand in his own lifetime, and thus very expensive and attractive to forgers. Writing from Venice to a friend in 1506, Dürer complains, quote, I have many enemies who copy my works in churches and wherever else they can get a hold of them. Close quotations. Dürer took his grievances to the authorities, and they ruled in his favor, proclaiming that to reproduce his monogram or signature was indeed illegal. But the picture itself at the time was free from copyright protection, and therefore anyone could reproduce it and sell it. One Italian copyist is said to have made over 80 facsimiles of Dürer's Life of the Virgin alone. He and a host of German forgers made fake Dürers of such high quality that they systematically fooled the most discerning experts. Things got worse after Dürer's death, with the value of his work increasing in consequence and causing forgeries to proliferate at a greater rate than ever. In 1528, his widow had to buy woodblock printing masters from the forgers to prevent them from making any more copies. Perhaps some fakes escaped detection still. Rumors persist to this day that museums throughout the world display Dürer forgeries described as original works by the master. A second and often companion question is, what's the difference between a copy and a forgery? The answer is simple. Disclosure. It's legal to sell a copy if it's not described as an original. In some countries, such as France, the work of copiste is highly regulated. Among other things, the copies cannot be of the same dimension as the originals. They cannot carry a forged signature, and they must be clearly marked as a copy somewhere on the back of the canvas or board. In other countries, like Canada and the United States, copying art is largely an unregulated free-for-all, like almost everything else in the art trade. But one thing is universally true. If you knowingly describe a replica as an original work, you're crossing the line between copying and forgery. Still, just to make life a little more complicated, that line is often quite blurred. For a long time, art schools encouraged their students to copy the works of the masters to learn painterly skills. Large group of painters at their easels diligently copying the Mona Lisa from life were a common sight at the Louvre well into the early 20th century. These were not Sunday painters, they were art students, and the better examples of their works found themselves hanging on the walls of relatives' living rooms, along with other copies from the 16th and 17th centuries, and in time found their way to the stalls of flea markets and antique dealers' shelves, where they can still be found. Which leads to a new problem, fraudulent misattribution. Here's how the swindle works. The perpetrators scour flea markets, antique shops, and junk dealers' stocks for what we can describe as genuine copies. This is a copy, most often of a classic subject by an old master, a Madonna and Child, say, or an Adoration of the Baby Jesus, made by a contemporary of the master. In other words, it's nothing more than an imitation, but the frame, the canvas, and the pigmentation are consistent with the epoch of the original. Prices and quality vary greatly for these works, but you could certainly purchase one for anywhere between $500 and $5,000, perhaps a little more in North America. Having purchased such a copy, the perpetrator claims it's an original old master, clamoring high and low that it's a genuine Rembrandt, Da Vinci, Van Dyck, Giorgione, whatever. To support this attribution, he collects a dizzying array of documentation, including detailed scientific reports, long-winded essays by so-called experts, and appraisals for astronomical sums. We'll see later how crooks can always find someone somewhere to ornament their swindles with bogus documentation. What he's done, or she, is compile a huge stack of documents of convenience prepared by accomplices, systematically avoiding the opinion of the people who really matter, namely scholars and authenticating committees. Does the perpetrator of this fraud want to sell his misattributed painting for millions? No, that would be impossible. Anyone with that sort of money required to buy one of these bogus paintings, one ambitious fellow set a value on a work of almost $300 million, would carry out due diligence and have careful expertise brought to bear, and that would blow the cover off the swindle. The perpetrator prefers to seek out people who will invest in the painting, promising prodigious returns when the work is eventually sold, which is never. As an appraiser and provenance researcher, with much of my work centering on forensic investigations related to art fraud, there's not much I haven't seen. Well, that's it for today. It's a bit of a foretaste, a little introduction, but also a caution. If someone comes to you with something that looks too good to be true, you can bet it's too good to be true. Okay, so please subscribe to Fakes, Frauds, and Phonies, and stay tuned for next week's episode where we'll be discussing some more very interesting cases, like a 500-year-old whodunit. I shall tell you no more. See you next week. Bye-bye.